From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Christina Shockley, in for Lester Graham. Today, a new book offers a timeline and analysis of what led to the Flint water crisis.
This crisis cannot be ignored, and this tale needs to continually be told.
That's later in the program. But first, we will start with our weekly roundup of political state news. Susan Demas is publisher of Inside Michigan Politics, and Ken Sikkema is former Senate Majority Leader and Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants. They join us via Skype. Welcome to you both.
Nice to be with you.
Thank you.
Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette filed civil lawsuits this week against Veolia and Lockwood Andrews and Newnham, or LAN. These companies were contracted by Flint during various stages of the switch to the Flint River. Schuette is claiming professional negligence and fraud in how they carried out their roles and responsibilities. The companies are fighting back, saying the allegations are false. Ken, in full disclosure, you were on the governor's Flint Water Task Force. So from your perspective, what's really going on here? Is Schuette trying to recoup some of the cost of the water crisis? Is this dissemination of some of the blame? Is it justice? Combination of all of the above? What do you think?
Well, I think it's a combination of all of the above. I think from my standpoint, the important issue here is getting at the truth of what happened. The task force, and I co-chaired it, as you mentioned, the task force on the Flint water crisis, we issued a report, and we certainly did not absolve these engineering firms. In fact, one of them that you mentioned, LAN, did not have a personal interview with us. They refused. They insisted on submitting written responses to written questions. And the task force believes that all of these investigations, including the lawsuits, are important to get at the final truth of exactly what happened.
Susan, what's your take?
Yeah, the companies have come back and they've said that the blame should be placed squarely on the Department of Environmental Quality and the state, citing the report from the Flint Water Task Force. But this gets at part of the background of this crisis that hasn't been probed as much. It's not just government that was involved in this process. There were outside companies, and because they're not subject to laws like FOIA, a lot of their role hasn't been known. Obviously, the Attorney General has far more power to get answers to some of these questions than reporters do. So it will be very interesting to see how this unfolds.
And then there's also the criminal investigation. Prosecutor Todd Flood is leading the state's investigation into the water crisis. And here's what he had to say about that this week.
If I don't get from all agencies, governor included, what I need and what we have a right for, they'll be in court.
Susan, can you give us more of a sense of what's going on here? Is there some tension between the AG's office and the governor's administration?
I believe that there is. The relationship between Attorney General Bill Schuette and Governor Rick Snyder has had tension in the past, and the Attorney General probes are very wide-ranging, and it's certainly not the only one out there. You have the FBI and other entities involved as well. You also have the factor of Bill Schuette looking to succeed the governor in 2018. He's term limited. And so there are many factors around what's going on with these investigations, political and otherwise.
Ken, your thoughts?
Well, I think Bill, the Attorney General is under a lot of pressure right now. And I think you're seeing some of that tension in his responses, because he still doesn't have a lot to show for sort of the hundreds of thousands of dollars that he spent of taxpayer money on the Flint water crisis. He's got one sort of low-level functionary who worked at the Flint water plant saying, hey, I didn't do my job as well as I should have. But that's about it at this point. And frankly, I think you're sort of getting the sense that pressure and the tension within his shop is starting to mount.
All right, let's go to presidential politics now, because, you know, we haven't heard enough about that. Some Michigan GOP delegates are joining the effort to stop Donald Trump from becoming the party's presidential nominee. We spoke with one of them earlier this week, Wendy Day. They're calling it the Dump Trump Movement. They want to change the rules at the national convention next month and allow delegates who are bound to Trump to vote for someone else. In general, how divided is the Michigan GOP over a potential Trump nomination? Susan?
Well, Donald Trump is still struggling to unify the Republican Party in Michigan and across the country. You have criticism from many different corners. Wendy Day is, you know, was Ted Cruz's Michigan chair. She's a strong fiscal and social conservative. So you have a lot of those folks who feel like Trump is not conservative enough. You have a lot of people who are highly critical of Trump's statements that have been very racially charged. And I think that if Trump were doing very well fundraising at the level that Hillary Clinton is, not making a bunch of gaffes, people would overlook that and you wouldn't see much traction for a dumb Trump movement. But, you know, success has many fathers and failure has none. And seeing an opportunity, I think people like Wendy Day are hoping to gain some traction at the convention. It will be rather difficult, and it could completely split the party in half if they really go forward and dump Trump as the nominee. But this is an unusual circumstance, and there are a lot of people with many different interests within the Republican Party, and you have a lot of people who are already looking forward to what the party will look like in 2020.
Ken, what do you think?
Part of what's going on is the people that are making the loudest noise about not wanting Trump as the nominee and getting involved in this dump Trump movement at the convention are the sort of arch conservatives. And because their whole mission in life politically is to sort of purify the Republican Party, make it the conservative Republican Party. They don't want moderates, and oh my God, we can't bear the thought of liberals in the party. So, and they don't know what Trump is, you know, and that's true whether it's from William Kristol at the, you know, head of the Weekly Standard and out of Washington, D.C., or Wendy Day here in Michigan. It's really these conservatives that are leading the charge as of late. And, you know, there are moderates sort of in the party, the few that are left, that are worried about his temperament more than anything. But it's really these conservatives that are worried about what he really stands for that are driving this.
Ken Sikkema is former Senate Majority Leader and Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants. And Susan Demas is publisher of Inside Michigan Politics. Thanks to you both.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
Whether you love it or hate it, the Oxford comma evokes some pretty strong feelings, both among people who study language and the rest of us. Why? Why do we let this tiny, curvy little line have so much control over us? Anne Curzan is an English professor at the University of Michigan and co-host of That's What They Say on Michigan Radio. She's here to help us understand the drama behind the Oxford comma. First, and what is the Oxford comma?
The Oxford comma is sometimes known as the serial comma. This is the comma in a list, and specifically it's the comma after the second to last item. So if we were to say she plays tennis, volleyball, and soccer, it would be the comma after volleyball. She plays tennis, comma, volleyball, comma, and soccer. But not everyone agrees that you have to have a comma after that second to last item.
Why are there different rules about the Oxford comma?
That's a great question. The people who are proponents of the Oxford comma will say it usefully disambiguates, right? So there's no question that the second to last item is still part of the list if it has a comma after it. And I see you nodding. Do you like the Oxford comma?
I love the Oxford comma, yes.
And I have to say, I also like the Oxford comma. I might even love the – no, I think I just like the Oxford comma. People have a lot of, as you said, a lot of strong feelings about the comma, including the people who don't like the Oxford comma, who will say it clutters up the sentence. It's unnecessary clutter. But for the people who like it, they will say there are sentences where it disambiguates the sentence. And there was this cartoon circulating on the internet about the Oxford comma. And it said, we invited two strippers, comma, JFK and Stalin. In the first version, there was an Oxford comma. And so you have four people, two strippers, and then JFK and Stalin. In the second version, no Oxford comma. And so you see this picture of JFK and Stalin dressed as strippers. And people say, see, you need the Oxford comma because otherwise it's confusing. My reaction is you have to work really hard to create that kind of sentence.
Why do we care so much?
A lot of people care about usage rules. And I think what we're seeing happen here is that grammar or usage comes to represent much more than grammar or usage. That somehow this is coming to represent a broader kind of order in the world, a kind of social order. It's also about education. And if you've spent a lot of time learning the rules of punctuation, I think we can become fond of them and want other people to learn them. Honestly, there's some gatekeeping that's happening here of sort of if I know them, you should know them. But we also just get fond of them. We like the way they look on the page.
Are we ever going to settle this?
I doubt that we're ever going to all come to agreement about exactly how commas are used. And I think in the end, what we need to remember is that punctuation's there to promote clarity on the page. We can sometimes get a little obsessed with consistency and say, you always have to have the Oxford comma or always not have the Oxford comma. But really, in the end, it's about whether it's clear on the page what the author's trying to tell us.
Anne Curzan is an English professor at U of M. She's also the co-host of That's What They Say here on Michigan Radio. Thanks, Anne.
Thanks.
Coming up, we will talk with a trained nose about how our sense of smell is central to who we are.
The first thing that a smell does is it hits the part of the brain that manages memory and emotion.
That's in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Christina Shockley in for Lester Graham. If you're heading up to the UP this summer for a vacation, maybe you'll stay in a hotel or maybe you'll be camping in a tent. One cartoonist from Chicago used to spend his summers in a cottage shaped like a pickle barrel. In Grand Marais, on the shore of Lake Superior, you can take a look at this unique little place. It's a pickle barrel-shaped structure. It's now a museum. Kathy Eager is treasurer and archivist for the Grand Marais Historical Society. Kathy, this pickle barrel-shaped cottage was built for cartoonist William Donahue. Who was he? It sounds like he had a unique personality.
Well, Bill Donahue was a cartoonist, and he was originally from the Ohio area, from a well-to-do family. He was the youngest of three boys and used to amuse himself by playing with little toy screws and animals and things that he would create himself. He loved things in miniature. And when he became older, he became a cartoonist for the Cleveland Plain Dealer and eventually went to the Chicago Tribune and syndicated what became a very famous cartoon called The Teeny Weenies, about little two-inch tall people that lived in a garden under a rose bush. And he ran these in the Sunday comics for over 50 years. To date, I believe it may be one of the longest-running cartoons ever published by the same author. So his stories were run every Sunday in the papers and became syndicated around the country. Stories of little people that had adventures in their little community, and everything that he published had something in it that had come from the human world, so you could see the proportions. They might make a house out of a shoe, or they might use playing cards as roofing materials. But the Teeny Weenies became very, very popular, and in the 1920s, the Monarch Food Company of Chicago licensed the characters to sell a whole brand of Teeny Weenie food products aimed at children. There were Teeny Weenie popcorn, Teeny Weenie peanuts, toffees, but their signature product was Teeny Weenie sweet pickles that were sold in a little 8-inch high wooden pickle keg. People would buy the keg at the store and then take the keg back to the store to be refilled. And one of his ads for the food company showed one of the wooden pickle kegs being used as a house for some teeny-weeny newlyweds. And the Monarch Food Company got the idea that, hey, we'll build a life-size pickle house for the creator. So they contracted with the barrel company in Chicago that was making the small barrels, and they created this double-barreled cottage house. The main barrel is 16 feet tall and has two stories. And there's an 8-foot-tall barrel attached at the rear that functions as a kitchen, and they're connected by a pantry. So what the barrel company did was they knocked it all apart, brought it up here on flat cars, and assembled it in the woods at Sable Lake, which is just west of the town of Grand Marais. And the Donahays used it as a summer cottage for 10 years. But in the intervening time, it became very popular and well-known, and sometimes they had up to 200 people a day showing up wanting to see inside their pickle house. And even on the weekends, they would lock the barrel on Sunday and go hide in the woods to get away from the company. So after 10 years of that, they got tired of all the people and gave it to a local Grand Marais businessman who moved it into town. And in the intervening years, it became an information center and an ice cream stand and a gift shop. But in 2003, the building had been empty for about 10 years and was becoming very dilapidated. So the Grand Marais Historical Society managed to find the money to purchase the property in the building and restore it so it looks like it did when it was the summer cottage out at Sable Lake. And today it's open for the public to come and visit.
Do you know, what did William Donahay think about this when he was presented with this idea about having a summer cottage that was in the shape of a pickle barrel?
Well, he'd been coming up here for many, many years to fish. It was one of his favorite places to be. And he was good friends with the president of the Monarch Food Company. So I think he went along with the idea. His wife didn't know anything about it. It was really a surprise for her. I don't think they anticipated how popular it would become. But they loved the children and they loved the visitors. It just became a little bit too much to have so many of them. But for 10 years, they used it every summer from May to October, and they stayed out at the lake. They didn't have any electricity or running water, but they had a pump and kerosene lanterns and wood stove heat, and they really enjoyed it. In fact, they liked the area so much that after the barrel was moved into town, they built a cabin on the same spot and continued to use it for the next 30 years or so.
And today it's a museum.
Yes, it is. We've restored it to look like it did when it was the cottage out at Sable Lake. It's open daily from 1 to 4 during July and August and on weekends in September and June. And we would love to have people come up and visit it. Children love it. We have a teeny-weeny treasure hunt for the kids. We have little teeny-weeny characters hidden throughout the building. And if they can find them all, we give them a prize. And people just love to come in and look around. So it's here, and we'd love to see people.
Does William Donahay still have family in the area?
He does. He and his wife, Mary, didn't have any children of their own, but some of his great nieces still live in the area, and they are, in fact, members of our historical society and help us maintain the building.
What do you find most interesting about William Donahay?
I'd have to say it was his connection to children. He started the Teeny Weeny cartoons when one of his neighbor's three-year-old daughters burst into tears upon seeing one of the contemporary Sunday comics of the time where someone was kicking someone down the stairs. And Donahay was very disgusted by this, and he said, by gosh, there's so much violence in these cartoons. I want to do something that's gentler for children. And that's what gave him the idea of the Teeny Weeny cartoons in the first place. So he went from there to create these famous cartoons, which were embraced by children around the world and ended up being syndicated in newspapers all over the world. Even after he moved the pickle barrel into Grand Marais and gave it to a local businessman, he continued to invite children out to visit him at the cottage, and he actually trained the local chipmunks in the woods to come out and do tricks with peanuts. He trained them to go up and down ladders and across tightropes and run around wheels. He had a little chipmunk circus, and the kids in town would ride their bikes out to see the chipmunk circus at the lake, and there are still some people in town today that remember doing that when they were children. So that's one of my favorite things about him, is his connection to the kids.
Kathy Eager is treasurer and archivist for the Grand Marais Historical Society. She spoke with me about the Pickle Barrel House Museum, which is in Grand Marais. Thanks, Kathy.
Thank you for letting me talk with you about it.
Now we're going to turn to one of our five senses, smell. Smells can evoke memories, tell us about our surroundings, and influence our mood. But can smells help people feel a sense of community? My next guest thinks so. Michelle Kralkid is the editor of the blog Glass Petal Smoke. It's about her endeavors into the world of smell. She's trained in the sense of smell and fragrances. Michelle, why is smell so important to us as humans?
Well, it's probably one of the most important senses that we have. We live in an ocular-centric culture, right? So everything comes to us as vision first. It's tangible. I can hold the glass in front of me. I can see your face. Smell is designed to do two things, basically. To protect us, right? So that we can smell smoke, natural gas, spoiled food, and then also so that we can enjoy life, which means that we get pleasure out of eating because taste plus smell equals flavor, and also so we can smell our loved ones and procreate and various other sundry items.
Now, you have brought three boxes here. We're going to focus on one. This is an aroma box. What is an aroma box?
An aroma box is a repurposed embroidery box from Target that's made of pine wood. So I sort of hacked the purpose, and I hid inside a little container with a blotter that has essential oil. And what that does, because it's an embroidery box with lots of dots going across and down, think of a confession screen in church, right? It's kind of like that, or a mosquito net or something like that. You can hold the box under your nose and smell it, and then just kind of let it do what it ever does to your senses. Does it make you remember something? Does it make you feel something? Does it sort of just stop you and make you feel peaceful? Is it agitating? It could do any number of things. But the first thing that a smell does is it hits the part of the brain that manages memory and emotion. So the reason why it's hard to describe a smell is because that's where that signal goes first. And then it goes into the part of the brain that manages language. And so because we live in a culture that's really more ocular-centric, which means, we, you know, what we see, we kind of struggle a little bit with coming up with words. We don't know what the right word is. And sometimes that stops people from wanting to say anything or feeling like, oh, what I'm going to say is dumb or stupid. And that really isn't the case, because what informs your vocabulary is your autobiographical memory and who you are. I mean, your essence, just like the essence in the box. So there is no wrong answer to what you're smelling at all. It's the truest truth you can ever get in touch with.
Okay, so we're going to do Douglas fir. There's a little, this is labeled as Douglas fir. It's a smallish box. And so what should I do? What do you want me to do here?
You know how a trombonist sort of slides the trombone? You need to find the right distance between your nose and the box, and you hold your nose over it. I'd say at least 3 inches, and then start pulling it away or closer to see what you get. And then just kind of be with that. And what's really important as you go through this process is that you allow yourself to be present with the aroma. And you'll have feelings of like, and you might have some feelings of dislike. But this is sort of like meditation. You need to kind of let those float and kind of get to what that is objectively. What do you think when you smell that?
So I'm feeling calm. What does that mean?
That's a good thing. What else? Just let it go. Remember, there are no wrong answers. There's no judgment.
I smell some flowers, some flowery.
There is a floral aspect to this particular essential oil.
And I smell like, you know, so, like I'm camping.
Now I know what you did during the summer.
You know what I'm also, now that I'm thinking of camping, I'm also smelling campfire.
Wow. So you see how it's, all the memories are layering on each other and intersecting. Now imagine if there were 10 people around you in a circle all doing the same thing and telling each other their stories. So I know something about you now because of what you've shared, and it's beautiful. And I might be sitting, or you might be sitting, or someone who maybe they're a different culture, a different race, English is not their first language, and then they're going to have a response. And then we get to learn about something we don't know.
So that's what you do. You hold these events where people do this together, and is that how that happens? They all sit in a circle and smell one of the boxes.
So right now we're using the aroma boxes. This is kind of a new invention that I made. What we typically do at a smell and tell setting is I use blotters made of a paper that's very similar to what watercolorists use, but it's designed for perfume, and I teach people how to smell off that because we usually smell about 8 or 10 things. So you would imagine with these boxes it'd be hard to do a lot of that.
And just describe what the smell and tell series is.
Sure. It started in 2012 at the Ann Arbor District Library. Smell and Tell has themes around aroma materials, history. You know, I've done things about musk, patchouli, exotic flowers, smell loss, if you can believe it, things like that. And I teach people the method I learned when I was training in perfumery, which is how to objectively evaluate a material. And so I think raw materials, just like, you know, a dish, tells a story. And that depends on what you've experienced in your life or what your experience right then in that moment, if that material is completely new to you.
My mother-in-law moved here recently from New Mexico. So we packed all of her belongings up in a pod, and it was moved here up to Michigan. And when we opened up the pod, it smelled like New Mexico.
Wow.
We moved everything into our garage where we're keeping things for the time being. And if we walk into the garage, it smells like we are at her house in New Mexico. Is there a way for us to preserve that in that smell, to keep that memory in an aroma box like this?
Okay. Wow. Whew. That's I'm just like kind of overwhelmed by that description because it's very beautiful. In my own experience, I grew up in the Bronx in twin apartment buildings and with people from a variety of cultures and backgrounds. So at around 5 o'clock, you could smell different food smells on different floors at different apartment doors. But the combination of all of those things for me defined the scentscape of that building and my childhood, really. And most people's places where they live have an aroma. They have an aroma because they're using cleaning products. They can wear perfume. They have soap. And then natural materials have a smell. If I gave you the aroma box without an odorant in it, you would smell the cut pine wood, right? So that becomes like right now that's in our scentscape. And that's a term. That's a legitimate term. There's a woman named, I think, Kate McLean, who does smell mapping. And you'll hear that language sort of float around. In terms of recreating that, you know, you're talking about time, dust. So you need to think about what makes you think New Mexico and make a list. And if there are items in nature, if there are essential oils available, you know, you can organize them in the box. And, you know, you don't have to do them the way I did it. I mean, if you have watercolor paper, you just put a few drops, throw it in the box, and it will have a smell. One of my friends actually took raw frankincense and put it inside the aroma box. And that was kind of interesting. It's less strong than putting frankincense oil on a blotter in a container. But she has very strong religious beliefs. So that was something that resonated for her.
It sounds like you perceive smell as being very closely tied to psychology and health. Tell me a little bit more about that.
So there's a few things with it. In terms of health, let's think about the opposite of smell, which is no smell. You can't detect smells. So if smell plus taste equals flavor, the experience of eating is going to be two-dimensional. And so people who lose their sense of smell can lose it for a number of reasons. If you don't wear a helmet and you fall off your bike or your motorcycle and you get a head injury that severs your olfactory nerve, it will not grow back and you will not have a sense of smell. And you could have other problems too. If you have the beginnings of a neurodegenerative disease of the brain, Alzheimer's, dementia, if you have MS, there's other diseases that one of the first signs is smell loss. I'm a little sad about this for a number of reasons because, you know, we can't cure dementia, right? The seed of memory, right? If smell is the catalyst for memory and you lose memory and you don't smell, that makes sense when you think about it, right? So many doctors, when they see patients who are older and have weight loss, will start to think they might have other diseases, you know, even cancer. They never ask them if they can smell. When a baby is born, every sense is tested except smell, and a test for that exists. It's never used. So people who are born without a sense of smell, they are called congenital anosmics, usually don't realize they can't smell until they're in their teen years, and they just kind of yes everything. But they're the ones that get sick from spoiled milk. They're the ones that don't smell natural gas, that kind of thing. So that's the health part. Now, in terms of wellness, I feel like since the sense of smell is memory sense, that when you hear somebody describe something and talk about what they're smelling, like they do at Smell and Tell or in life, you learn about a person. Some people are very attached to likes and dislikes and have a really hard time being in that middle space. And I think, you know, as we get older and wiser, we get more comfortable in that middle space. For me, because I'm a bit of a hybrid, I love art and science and other things, it's very important to stand in a middle space. When you're collaborating, you need to be in a middle space and not have attachment. And, you know, I think the preponderance of yoga and all these other things that we've absorbed from Eastern culture are because we so desperately need that. If you want to take that on a different spiritual level, you know, our ego is going to drive us to be first. And that needs to be tempered. So I feel like sitting down and smelling something and then sort of being with it and letting yourself kind of go through the human experience of remembering is powerful. I think that these aroma boxes could be used therapeutically. If someone has PTSD, if there are things that make them feel good, they could use it. If someone's in hospice and they're getting ready to transition, maybe there's some things that they love that they'd want. Maybe you lost a loved one, and you, going back to your mother-in-law story, you know, maybe there are things you want that remind you of that person. Put them in the box.
Michelle Krell-Kidd is the editor of the blog Glass, Petal, Smoke. It's about her endeavors into the world of smell. Michelle, thank you so much for coming in to talk with me about this.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Still to come, childcare is expensive, but that doesn't mean caregivers are rolling in cash.
About 75 to 80% of a program's budget is salaries, so there's not a lot of money being made in the early childhood field.
A look at the importance and economics of early childhood education. Plus, a new book gives us a detailed timeline of how the Flint water crisis unfolded. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Christina Shockley, in for Lester Graham. Around 90% of a child's brain is already developed by the time they are 5 years old. And that means the learning that takes place before a kid even reaches kindergarten can have a lifelong impact. Decades of research shows that high-quality preschool can increase graduation rates and future earnings. But while many agree that preschool is a critical investment, early childhood educators earn far less than other teachers. In some states, you can make more working at a fast food restaurant. Here to talk about why that matters is a professor of early childhood education at Eastern Michigan University. Karen Pisorek, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, Christine. It's good to be here.
What kind of a salary do most early childhood educators make?
Most childcare teachers, which are those individuals that work with children before they enter kindergarten, nationwide average about $10 to $11 an hour. It's below the poverty line for many of these providers.
Why is that?
Well, it's such a labor-intensive field. If you're working with infants, you need one adult for every four children in the state of Michigan to be a licensed program. You need a large number of people to be support service within the program, which would be your food service, your administrative people, your director. It just is a profession that requires a lot of people with all hands on deck. The ratio does get slightly better with preschool children, toddlers, 1 to 8, 1 to 10, 1 to 12 for preschool children, one adult for every 12 children. It's very labor intensive.
Now, many people know that sending a child to a daycare center or to a preschool is very expensive. Mm-hmm. So why doesn't that translate into a higher rate of pay?
Because of the ratio, so much of the tuition payment the parents pay has to go to salaries. About 75 to 80% of a program's budget is salaries. So there's not a lot of money being made in the early childhood field. The directors aren't walking around with handfuls of money. Elaborate trips or materials aren't being spent. It's just mainly on staff.
What are some of the ramifications of this pay gap?
Well, we have a number of them, being the poor quality care, where you have people who do not have the academic preparation, the background, the knowledge of child development, guiding children in their most formative years. I liken it to building a home or a building that you want to last for 100 years. And if you use poor construction materials, you water down the cement, you use boards that are not of high quality, you are not going to get a finished product that is of high caliber. And the same thing happens with early childhood. People who aren't skilled in how to guide children's behavior will yell at them, will provide limited language. So children in those environments are not getting the background during their formative years that they would need if they were to be successful learners throughout life.
It can be very difficult and stressful to decide what kind of childcare arrangement is right for
Absolutely.
Your children, for your family. Many times it depends on if the parents or one parent or a guardian is going to go back to work and how that's all going to work. How can we both help parents during this time and make sure that young kids are getting the kinds of experiences that they need to grow and develop their young brains?
We can help parents by giving them the equipment they need to search for childcare. What are some of the questions you want to ask when you're looking for care? What do you want to see when you go out there? You can even, if it's public information, look for the salary that this individual might make. Is it a salary that you think is worthy of someone who is caring for your children? Had a situation a few years ago. I was talking to someone, and this director in Ann Arbor actually posted for Month of the Young Child, which is in April, the salary, the educational level and the salary of all the teachers in the classroom. And she did this with the teacher's permission. One of the parents said to me, "I can't believe what those teachers make. Oh, my gosh, I'm floored." This parent was a hairstylist and volunteered to cut for free the hair of any of the teachers in that program because they recognized that that was an expense that these teachers couldn't afford.
It seems like there's a problem here because early childhood education and daycare preschool is very expensive, yet that's not translating into what you're saying is a reasonable rate of pay
right.
for the educators. What's the answer?
It's complicated. The answer would be some subsidy. We do need to have options for families. Just take college tuition. All the focus has been on the expense of going to college. Well, when someone is going to go to college, parents generally know that, well, in 18 years, my child will go to college. We have savings plans you can start for your child when they're born to go to college. You can walk into any bank in this country and get a loan for college. That's an acceptable, I need a loan to go to college. You can't say, "Hi, I'd like to get a loan to send my child to childcare." That's not something that we do in this country. So we need to recognize that parents are at their lowest earning point when they're paying for childcare, and they need support. We need to have more subsidies. We need to provide some more what's called a sliding scale. So parents who are at the lower income level will pay less than parents who are able to, who can pay more. Some programs do that. They offer a sliding scale. Others, it's one cost for no matter what the parent makes. Recognizing that parents need to be able to get support to pay for children, and only those programs that hire quality teachers will be eligible for that support.
Is one piece of this puzzle the fact that early childhood educators are predominantly women, and typically the early childhood raising years fall on mothers to take the lead? That's changing, but that's typical, I think you can
generally
argue.
Yes, you're right, Christine.
Is that necessary to understanding this issue of what we're talking about here?
It is. We've looked at it for years as women's work, as mother's job. You know, mothers and grandmothers have been doing it for free for years. And people think that, oh, all you're doing is babysitting. How hard can it be? I pay the neighbor girl a couple bucks an hour to watch my child. When people have that thinking, yes, it is hard to change, but now we have the research, the data that strongly supports children being in high-quality programs for their first 5 years. We can't just look at kindergarten as being the starting point for school. You bring the skills that you've learned your first 5 years to kindergarten, and you either start that race on the inner lane of that track or you're starting that race on the outer lane of that track. And it's not a staggered start. You are running the entire race on the outside of that lane of that track. And we need to give everybody the skills they need to be successful.
Karen Pisorek is a professor of early childhood education at Eastern Michigan University. Thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you for having me.
This This is Stateside. I'm Christina Shockley. The Flint water crisis is now an important piece of the city's story and history. It will affect the city and its residents for decades to come. Michigan Radio and countless other local and national news outlets have reported various aspects of the crisis, from how it unfolded to how the crisis will continue to affect the city's children as they grow into adults. The Center for Michigan's Bridge magazine has now published a book that aims to bring the story, at least what we know now, together in one place. The book is called Poison on Tap: How Government Failed Flint and the Heroes Who Fought Back. John Bebo is president and CEO of the Center for Michigan. John, there's been a lot of reporting on this crisis, although many would argue that that reporting didn't happen soon enough. What does this book give us that we don't already have?
What we seek to do with this book, Christina, is to wrap the story into one place. It's such a busy media climate for concerned citizens, and there has been so much news that has come out over the past year on the Flint water crisis. We hope this is a service for concerned Michigan residents or people concerned anywhere about local democracy and water issues and public safety, where you can get the essentials in one place. We make no claim to own this story. In fact, if anybody owns it, it might be Michigan Radio and some of your reporting very early on. But what we're trying to do here is wrap this story into one place.
The book is largely a timeline with dates and descriptions of when exactly things happened. You also have analysis from your reporters and writers, and you have analysis from the Truth Squad. As you were putting all of this together, who was your audience? Who is this book for?
You know, I hope this doesn't sound too odd, but our first audience was ourselves. Bridge, like many media outlets, was covering the Flint water crisis somewhat over the past year. Our coverage dates back to January of 2015. But what really drove us to go much deeper and develop a rat-a-tat timeline of what happened in Flint, it started with an issue of Tim Skubick's Off the Record show in January. Two really respected guests were on that night, Bill Ballinger, the former publisher of Inside Michigan Politics, and Gretchen Whitmer, the former Senate minority leader in the Michigan Senate. What they both had to say struck me personally as so incredible and outrageous that our team immediately started to dig deeper. Bill Ballinger said, "I run Flint water over my rice every night, and there's no problem in Flint." And that just struck me as incredible. And Gretchen Whitmer followed that up by saying, "The governor of Michigan poisoned the children of Flint." That struck me as equally incredible. And instead of dropping into Flint and covering a story at the street level and then pulling back out, which had been our initial approach, we decided to go as deep as we could and get every document we could. And that's part of what we're trying to do with this book, is to protect against revisionist history on all sides and to provide readers with incremental detail by incremental detail of what happened so they can make some of their own decisions about who's to blame and what happened. But the story was spinning so out of control pretty early on. And then there was this incredible release of documents. You should never say never, but I'll be surprised if we ever see this level of government decision-making on such blunt display as eventually came out through the Flint water crisis. I think that began with Mark Edwards, the Virginia Tech professor who's one of the real heroes of this story, making information requests to state agencies and then releasing those records on a blog. The records were released and a few reporters picked up on them, but there was an incredible amount of detail. And at the center and at Bridge, we're public policy geeks. So when you see all those details in government emails that you rarely get to see, just an incredible, incredible amount of detail, and then the governor's emails on top of that, what we're trying to represent in this book is how decisions get made, how mistakes get made, how miscommunication happens, some of the competing forces in play.
We're talking with John Bebo. He's the president and CEO of the Center for Michigan. They have a new book out this week about the Flint water crisis. It's called Poison on Tap: How Government Failed Flint and the Heroes Who Fought Back. If you had to describe the narrative of this book to someone from Oregon, from a different state, what would your elevator pitch be? What's the narrative of this book?
Wherever you are on the political spectrum in this very divided country, if you are a Tea Partier or if you are a tax and spend liberal, the Flint water crisis should outrage you to the maximum degree.
Why?
Because there were so many mistakes at so many levels. A perfect storm of utter failures that caused this crisis. It's a parable for troubled cities across our country. That's another reason we wanted to amplify to this to a book, because this is not just about Flint. The circumstances, what happened in Flint, can happen in so many other places so easily that we don't want this story to go away. We want this to be studied and to be understood and to be fixed beyond the crisis on the ground in Flint.
In a way, you only captured here the beginning of this story, because this story is still unfolding. There are going to be a lot of effects that we don't even know yet. What is still missing from what we do know? You have a pretty good timeline here. Where are the gaps in this timeline?
I think the discovery processes of the criminal investigations and of the civil lawsuits and the audits that various government agencies are doing on themselves and on each other could provide more detail. And obviously, the story's only half told. The other shoes haven't dropped. There are criminal cases and lawsuits that are continuing. And as we describe in the book, this book represents the headwaters of this tale. There's years more to come out of this as Flint attempts to recover. Here's what's not missing. There is an incredible amount of detail, not just in this book, but was available in the public sphere in this case. This was a major public health crisis, and the amount of dialogue between government agencies and the windows into the decisions they made, the missteps they made, it's really instructive and it's really rare. We rarely get to see this level of detail about, in this case, how very broken some of our government systems are.
The governor at the Mackinac Policy Conference called the media a bunch of Eeyores for dwelling on the past and not looking to the optimistic future. This book is about the past. What do you make of the governor's remarks?
I can understand his frustration, and it is his nature to be forward-looking and always positive. But this crisis cannot be ignored, and this tale needs to continually be told. There's so much unrest in this country. There's so much dismay across political systems. But there is inspiration coming out of Flint. Government failed. The people did not. The citizens demanded answers all the way to the White House. Dr. Mona got them answers as the state health department was saying, no problem. Mark Edwards, vigilant watchdog as he is, came in here and finally told the truth when state agencies were denying it for months. That's what our country is based on, self-representation and people taking matters into their own hands. And that's what happened here. Flint may be splintered, but it is not completely broken because that portion of democracy worked.
The role of reporters in many ways is to obviously tell a story, but also to illuminate, especially when it comes to this story, to further the discussion, to bring awareness, to potentially bring change, which is what the Flint residents were screaming for. What do you think about how the Michigan media have handled this crisis?
I'll quote the Flint Water Task Force, which was bipartisan experts in public policy and public health. They very much complimented the media for being the watchdogs that we in the media strive to be, and for one of the reasons that the entire crisis came to light. I think without Kurt Guyette's reporting at the American Civil Liberties Union and Michigan Radio's very early reporting, I think some of the documents, which are now well known, would not have been amplified. As the Flint Water Task Force said, without that work and the work of some of the other heroes in Flint, the citizens of Flint may still be drinking tainted water. And that's where I take issue with the governor. This can't go away. There are too many lessons that need to be learned here so that we don't have this happen again.
Where do we go from here? How do we make sure that this story is told completely and fully?
Well, part of our take on that was to make sure that the story known to date is told as completely as you can. This book is incremental detail after incremental detail. I think a lot of readers will scan it more than read every single word. We did that intentionally because we don't want revisionist history here. We saw it earlier this winter. The Environmental Protection Agency came out and said, oh, we tried to fix the problems in Flint. We're calling BS on that. No, they didn't. They sat on Miguel de Toro, their own experts, deep, deep concerns about Flint for months. They hold some responsibility here, and they have already tried revisionist history, and we don't want that revisionist history to happen. That's why this book is being put out there.
John Bebo is the president and CEO of the Center for Michigan. They have a new book out this week about the Flint water crisis. It's called Poison on Tap: How Government Failed Flint and the Heroes Who Fought Back. John, thanks for talking with me about this.
It is my great pleasure to be here.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstraw. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Ryan Grimes, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Christina Shockley. Thanks for listening.